Chapter 35. The Swiss Accounts. That August, I took David for a father-son trip to the English countryside. One day, as we were hiking up a cliffside trail in Cornwall, an unexpected gift fell in my lap. It came in the form of a phone call from Jamie Firestone. Jamie was so excited he could barely get the words out. "Hey, Bill, can I make your day?" "Always ready for that." I caught my breath from the steep trail while David stopped in a patch of shade to drink some water. "What's happening?"
"I just got an email from someone who claims to have proof that a woman at Moscow Tax Office number 28 got millions from the fraud."
"Who sent the email?"
"Someone named Alejandro Sanchez."
"That doesn't sound very Russian. How do you know it's not bullshit?"
"I don't. But he sent me some Swiss bank statements and some offshore company documents in his email."
"What do they say?"
"They show a bunch of wire transfers going to bank accounts that seem to belong to the husband of Olga Stepanova, the lady at the tax office who signed the refund check."
"That's amazing. Do you think they're real?"
"I don't know, but Sanchez said that if we're interested, he's willing to meet."
"Are you comfortable doing that?"
"Sure,"
Jamie said almost dismissively. Even after all that had happened, Jamie hadn't lost his optimism.
"Don't worry, Bill."
We hung up, and I took a few sips of water. David and I put our heads down and kept walking up the trail. But I hardly noticed the beautiful views over the beach. My head was spinning. The campaign needed a break like this, but I was worried about sending Jamie into harm's way. Nowhere was safe, especially London, which was rife with Russians. In 2006, Alexander Litvinenko, a former FSB agent and well-known Putin critic, was poisoned by FSB agents at London's Millennium Hotel, just across the street from the American Embassy. Jamie and Sanchez exchanged a few more emails and agreed to meet each other on August 27, 2010. The plan was for them to sit down, and if Sanchez appeared legitimate, Jamie would call Vadim to join them to go over the documents. Sanchez suggested the Polo Bar at the Westbury Hotel in Mayfair, which was ominously close to where Litvinenko had been poisoned. Terrified that something awful would happen, I called our security guy, Stephen Beck, to come up with a plan. Stephen surveyed the location and decided to bring in four men to watch over Jamie and Vadim. Two were ex-special forces, and two were former British intelligence officers. At 2:30 p.m. on the 27th, these men began to show up in the Polo Bar, one at a time. They took up strategic positions, two by the exits, one near the table where the meeting would occur, one at the end of the bar. They blended in seamlessly. One carried a device that could detect and jam any surveillance equipment similar to the kind that we thought Sargeryan might have used for the meeting at the Dorchester Hotel. Another did a discreet walkthrough with a Geiger counter to check for any radiation, since Litvinenko had been poisoned with a highly toxic radioactive isotope of polonium. There were no guarantees, but I knew that if things got ugly, Stephen's guys would get Jamie and Vadim out of there in a hurry. Jamie got to the Polo Bar early, entering through one of the steel and glass double doors. He walked through the low-ceilinged Art Deco lounge to the reserved table. He sat in one of the blue velvet club chairs with his back to a wall, a picture of the Empire State Building hanging over his shoulder. The position was strategic, deemed by Stephen to be the safest place in the room. Jamie tried to pick out the guards from the crowd of tourists, but was at a loss. He looked along the length of the green and black marble bar as the bartender shook a martini and poured it into a frosted glass. A waitress brought him a small tray of complimentary snacks, and he eyed the smoked almonds before thinking better of it. He ordered a Diet Coke with a slice of lemon. When he arrived, he let it sit on the table untouched. Anything could be poisoned. Sanchez arrived 15 minutes late. In his early 40s, he was about 5 feet 10 inches and had a paunch. He was wearing a tan sport jacket,
dark slacks, and a white shirt with no tie. His brown hair was unkempt. His skin was milky. His eyes nervous and intense. As soon as he spoke, it was evident that he was no Alejandro Sanchez.
"Please excuse the alias, Mr. Firestone," he said in Russian, "but I have to be careful."
"I understand," Jamie answered, also in Russian, wondering if all the other people in the bar were security personnel for Sanchez.
"My real name is Alexander Perepelichny."
Jamie motioned for the waitress as Perepelichny dropped into a chair. He ordered green tea as Jamie tried to size him up. Perepelichny did the same to Jamie. The tea was served. Perepelichny said,
"Thank you for agreeing to see me."
"Of course. We're very interested in what you have to say." Perepelichny lifted the teacup and took a careful sip. He put the cup down. Both men stared at each other in awkward silence. Then Perepelichny said,
"I got in touch with you because I saw the videos about Kuznetsov and Karpov. Magnitsky's death was shocking. Every Russian accepts corruption, but torturing an innocent man to death is crossing the line."
Bullshit, thought Jamie. He knew that these days most Russians didn't operate on high-minded principles like these. Everything in Russia was about money, making it, keeping it, and making sure no one took it. Jamie had no idea what Perepelichny's real agenda was, but he was confident that the man wasn't sitting here because he cared about Sergei. "The information in your email is good, but incomplete," Jamie said. "Do you have any more documents?" Perepelichny said,
"Yes, but not with me."
Jamie leaned back in his chair, the ice in his Diet Coke shifting as it melted. "Would you mind if one of my colleagues joined us? I'd like him to go over the documents you provided. When we're sure we understand them, we'll tell you what else we need." Perepelichny agreed. Jamie pulled his phone from a pocket and texted Vadim, who was waiting on New Bond Street right around the corner. 2 minutes later, Vadim pushed through the entrance, made his way to the table, and introduced himself. As Vadim sat, Jamie pulled out Perepelichny's documents. Vadim leafed through them and asked,
"Do you mind walking me through these?" "Sure. This is a Credit Suisse bank statement for an account owned by Vladyen Stepanov, husband of Olga Stepanova."
Perepelichny indicated a line midway down the page.
"Here's a transfer for 1.5 million euros on May 26th. Here's one for 1.7 on June 6th. And here's another for 1.3 million on June 17th.
He ran his finger over several other transactions. All told, in May and June of 2008, 7.1 million euros had been transferred into this account. Jamie squinted at the documents. "Where did you get these?" Perepelichny shifted uncomfortably.
"Let's just say I know some people."
Jamie and Vadim didn't like this, but they didn't want to spook Perepelichny, so they didn't press him. Vadim flipped through the papers.
"This could be very useful, but I don't see Vladyen Stepanov's name in any of the bank statements. How are they connected to him?" "That's simple. The account belongs to a Cypriot company owned by Vladyen."
Perepelichny pointed to an ownership document with Vladyen's name on it, but not his signature. Vadim lowered his glasses. He'd been investigating corporate fraud for over 13 years, and his standard practice was to assume everything was a lie until he saw evidence to prove otherwise.
"Thank you. But without proof that Stepanov actually owns this company, there is not much we can do with this. We need copies of these ownership papers with his signature."
"I understand,"
Perepelichny said.
"This was just meant to be a first meeting. I can come back with what you're asking for if you'd like to meet again."
"Yes, that'd be great," Jamie said. With that, they finished the meeting, shook hands, and Perepolichny got up and left. When Vadim returned to the office to report what had happened, I was suspicious and said, "It sounds like a scam."
"Maybe. But if what he's saying is true, this would be the first time we could show exactly how some of these people got money from the tax rebate fraud."
"Fair enough. Let's see if Perepolichny can produce what he promised." A week later, they agreed to meet again. This time they would be joined by Vladimir Pastukhov, who, because of his near blindness, had an amazing sixth sense for people. The following Tuesday, Vadim and Vladimir met Perepolichny back at the polo bar. True to his word, Perepolichny produced a copy of a signed document showing that Vladyen Stepanov owned the Cypriot company with the Credit Suisse bank statements. When Vadim and Vladimir came back to the office and showed me the document, I was not impressed. It looked like a simple piece of paper with some illegible signatures on it. Anyone could have made it or forged it. "What is this? I can barely read it."
"This is from Stepanov's auditor," Vadim said.
It seemed to me that they were too ready to believe Perepolichny. "This could be anybody's signature. Do you really think we should trust this guy?"
"I do," Vadim said. "I think he's for real."
"What do you think, Vladimir?"
"I believe him too. He seems honest."
They continued to meet over the following weeks, and we learned some interesting things. In addition to the Swiss accounts, Perepolichny told us how the Stepanovs had purchased a six-bedroom villa and two luxury condominiums on the Palm Jumeirah, a massive man-made archipelago shaped like a palm tree in Dubai. The market value of these properties was around $7 million. In Russia, the Stepanovs built a mansion in the most fashionable suburb of Moscow that was valued at $20 million. In total, they'd amassed bank accounts and properties worth nearly $40 million. To help illustrate just how lavish and ridiculous these expenditures were, Vadim got hold of the Stepanovs' tax filings, which showed that since 2006, their average annual income was only $38,281. This information was so good that I was sure it would go viral if we produced another YouTube video. Adding Olga Stepanova to our collection of Russian untouchables would shake the Russian elite right to the core. There was one problem, though. Perepolichny's story wasn't just good. It was too good. It was entirely plausible that Perepolichny was working for the FSB, and that this was a well-planned operation to destroy my credibility. It was right out of their playbook. Create a character with a believable story. Have this person pass valuable information to his target. Wait for the target to disclose this information publicly. Then show how the information is false. If this scenario played out, it would entirely compromise all the work we had done over the last 3 years with journalists and governments throughout the world. It wouldn't take long for policymakers to ask, "Why are we backing this liar at the expense of our important relationship with Russia?" If we were going to make a video about the Stepanovs, I had to be certain that what Perepolichny said was true, and I also needed to know how he'd gotten his information. For a long time, he was cagey on this point, but finally, he let down his guard. He told us the reason he had so many of these financial documents was that he'd been a private banker for a number of wealthy Russians, including the Stepanovs. This vocation worked well for Perepolichny until 2008, when the markets crashed and he lost the Stepanovs a lot of money. According to Perepolichny, instead of accepting these losses, the Stepanovs accused him of stealing the money and demanded he repay them. Since Perepolichny had no intention of covering their market losses, Olga Stepanova used her position as head of the tax office to get a criminal tax evasion case opened against Perepolichny. Perepelichny promptly fled Russia to avoid arrest. He moved his family to a rented house in Surrey, a fashionable London suburb, where he lay low. He first watched the Kuznetsov and Karpov videos in Surrey and came up with an idea. If he could get us to make a Russian Untouchables video about Olga Stepanova and her husband, then it could possibly compromise them to such an extent that it would make his problems go away. When Vladimir told me this, it made sense, and I was finally ready to go ahead and use his information to make a video. But just as we started to get comfortable with Perepelichny, we received a new message from our source Aslan. Department K furious about Kuznetsov and Karpov videos. Large new operation being planned against Hermitage and Browder. We asked for clarification, but Aslan didn't have any more details. My fears that Perepelichny was part of an FSB plot came roaring back. Maybe everything was going according to plan. It didn't matter how compelling his information was. Before going forward, I had to be doubly sure that we weren't falling headfirst into an FSB trap.